Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. As our faithful listeners know, we dedicate Wednesdays on Local Talk to discussions outside of Ames in the surrounding communities of Story County and even the surrounding counties beyond Story in our listening area. Later in the show, we've got a story on a paid farm internship program that offers aspiring farmers the opportunity to get the learning they need to be successful. And in fact, after just 2 years, the program has already had successes. We also continue the story of One Heart Equestrian Therapy with reporter Kay Puddock, who will be joining us. In the first part of the show, it's State House Politics, with conversations about the K-12 education budget and this year's gun laws. But for now, on the studio line with me is our Local Talk regular, Keith Morgan. Keith joins us on the first Monday of every month. He's here today with a special message about what's happening tomorrow. Keith?
Good morning.
Hi. I understand it is Severe Weather Awareness Week.
It is, and as a part of that, typically we do a statewide tornado drill on Wednesdays, but today is Wednesday, but they're going to actually shift it over to Thursday because there is the chance of severe weather in the southern part of the state.
And the drill is not your normal noontime siren, right?
No, it's actually going to be a test of the entire alert system. It's going to start off with the National Weather Service generating a simulated tornado watch followed by a tornado warning, and then they're going to actually activate many of their systems that they use to disseminate that information, to include the system that sends the messages to our dispatch agencies and also to your weather radio. So everybody that has a weather radio should be looking for this to be happening. It's going to start off at about 10 o'clock on Thursday with the generation of a watch, and then they're going to move at 10:20. They're actually going to issue a simulated tornado warning. So everybody should be checking for that.
Okay, and will the warnings that we get, you know, have a little asterisk after them that say this is just a test so that people don't panic?
Exactly. Over the weather radios, they'll announce that it is just a test of the overall system. But throughout our systems, we're going to be putting out messages, and those messages that would be received at the dispatch agencies will have that it's a simulated tornado watch and warning. But they're going to treat it like it's the real thing here in Story County, and they're going to move all the way through the steps that they would need to activate the individual outdoor warning sirens that we have across the county.
That's right. It wouldn't just be one siren. It would be a whole bunch of them.
We're fortunate here in Story County that our sheriff's dispatch agency has the ability to set them all off or to set them off individually. And that can be a bit of a complex system, so this is a perfect time for us to make sure that all of those different steps along the way are still working, so that when we do need these outdoor warning sirens, that we have greater confidence that they're going to activate.
I think it's kind of interesting that you're not doing it today, Wednesday, because today there actually might be severe weather in southern Iowa.
That's right. We're very, very cautious about the possibility of people thinking, oh, it's just the test when it's the real thing.
Right.
So that's why a couple of days ago they were looking at the possibility of severe weather down south, and yesterday they decided to push it back one more day.
Okay. And a lot of people might not necessarily hear the siren because it's an outdoor siren.
You caught my use of term outdoor warning siren. I've had people say, you know, I can't hear those sirens in my house. And I say, that's great. You've got a well-insulated house with some good windows. They are specifically designed to warn those people that are outside that have less ability to be aware that there's severe weather coming, to get inside and to get protection inside the house. One of the most important things is for everybody to have a weather radio. And we also include businesses in this, that they also need to have some way of being alerted to severe weather coming their way. And the weather radios are great for a house because in the middle of the night, when you may not hear a cell phone or some other way that you normally get your alerts, it will wake you up and it will give you that very, very valuable warning.
Well, you mentioned cell phones, and that's something I don't even have programmed yet on my cell phone. I noticed when I went to your homepage this morning over at Story County Emergency Management Agency that you have a means for Story County residents to sign up for those cell phone alerts, you know, texts and emails. And that's something I think I might do right after this show.
And this is a great time to talk about that. That system will be for me personally to be able to, myself or somebody within a city, to be able to warn you about other kind of warnings. We're reserving that. We are not using it for weather warnings because the system itself is a little bit slow on being able to get all the people warned, and by the time it gets through, that warning may have changed. So what we really encourage people to do is to first sign up for that mass notification system that we call Story County Iowa Alerts. It's available on our webpage, because if there are other kinds of emergencies, that will be the way that we'll get hold of you. For the weather stuff, there are a lot of good apps on all of the different media outlets down in Des Moines, have good apps that you can personalize for what you want to get for that weather kind of information. The National Weather Service itself does have, for those most important warnings, it's called the Wireless Emergency Alert System, that it will go to your to the newer cell phones and alert you for flash flooding and tornadoes. So even the National Weather Service has kind of narrowed down the kinds of alerts that they're putting out over cell phones.
Well, I will try to track that app down and make a link to it available on our homepage so people can follow up on that. It sounds pretty important. Keith, thank you so much for your helpful reminders. We'll be on the alert a little after 10 a.m. tomorrow.
Yep.
Well, it's crunch time at the State House, where final decisions and deals are being made before the legislature adjourns. As you recall, last year saw a lot of drama around the issue of K-12 education funding, with the governor vetoing the one-time education spending bill the Republicans had offered as a concession to Senate Democrats, who had voted for a 4% increase but only got 1.25%. This year, it's a little bit smoother sailing. Last night, I talked with Herman Kernbach from Ames, the chair of the Senate Education Appropriations Committee.
On Tuesday, the conference committee met on the allowable growth bill. That's the bill that determines the increase in the per pupil spending authority for local school districts. The number that was agreed upon was 2.25%. So that means about $140 more per student. 2.25% barely keeps pace with inflation. So it really isn't any kind of an increase that we could be proud of, and not anywhere near what our school districts need. I think a lot of school districts have told us, including Ames, that if we're down in the 2% range, they're going to have to make cuts. You know, the House and Senate Democrats had gone in together to do a survey of school superintendents and principals very early in the session, and of 257 responses, exactly 3 agreed with the Republican position of 2%. 88% wanted at least 4%. That's what they said they needed to meet their local school district's needs. So this is not coming anywhere near close to adequate. And the reason, frankly, is that, you know, the budget won't permit it, but the budget won't permit it because of self-inflicted wounds. Over the last 3 or 4 years, we have passed tax cuts totaling over $400 million a year. The difference between 2% and 4% would have been about $90 million. We could have done 4% and still cut taxes $300 million instead of 4. So the priorities coming out of the governor's office and the Republican House are more slanted towards tax cuts. I don't think we can really say that education is the first priority for Iowa anymore, at least not by our budgetary actions.
Can you just be a little specific about what types of tax cuts these are?
Well, the biggest one agreed to 3 years ago was a commercial property tax cut. That's costing the state treasury about $300 million. I voted against that. Not that I thought that there shouldn't be some relief on commercial property. I had voted for smaller packages in the years before, But in 2013, we went overboard. The number just got more than we could afford, and that's what's really been strangling the budget in a lot of ways, but especially the budget for education, because that's such a big piece.
Okay, so this 2.25% increase in school K through 12 funding, is that pretty much a sure thing at this point?
I would say that that is what is going to get approved. Yes, the conference committee report has to be approved by a vote of the House and by a vote of the Senate, but I don't see any other outcome coming forward.
And the and that is for this coming year. Are you going to go ahead and budget for the following year as the law states that you must?
Interesting you should ask that. That's exactly the question that I posed to the House Republican Education Chair today at the conference committee meeting. He's on the conference committee. I asked him, when do they intend to move the bill for fiscal year 18, for the 2017-18 school year? You know, the law says we're supposed to do it a year and a half in advance. The Senate passed them over a bill back in about the 10th of February, within the first 30 days, like the law says. They never took it up. They didn't even file a bill of their own. And they have been pretty clear in their public statements that they intend to thumb their nose at the law again. The conference committee report that we're talking about here should have been agreed to a year before, should have been agreed to a year ago. The House, again, we sent them a bill. They never took it up within the legal time frame. So, you know, they've continually broken the law, and they come in with inadequate numbers. It's just a mess. It's just a mess. We're not doing for our kids what we ought to be doing for them. They are our future. We keep saying that, but that's not the way our friends in the House vote.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Herman Kurmbach, for getting us up to date on education funding.
Okay. Well, look, I wish the news were better, but thank you for your interest.
Guns are also on the State House agenda this year, and we've covered this issue on Local Talk. This time, we spoke with an Ames woman, Jess Calhoun, who was down in the Capitol last Wednesday with a group of activists called Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense. Here's Jess Calhoun with her story.
Well, so I'm a stay-at-home mom. I have three young kids, and until recently, I wasn't really involved in any sort of activism at all. But then in 2012, Sandy Hook happened. That was the horrific shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary. And I felt so devastated on that day that I sought out something to do. And the day after that happened, this group was founded on Facebook by another parent who at the time was living in Indiana. And I found it. I joined it. And now we have over 20,000 members in Iowa, over 3 million members nationally. And it's really grown from this small effort on social media to something much larger. At the time of Sandy Hook, I had a daughter who was about the age of those first graders. I have three kids under the age of 7 now, so young kids, and I just very much saw them in the faces of those kids that were taken in Connecticut. But, you know, since I started working on this issue, I came to understand more that we don't just have a mass shooting problem. We have a gun violence problem. And this goes, you know, this is in every home, every town. Our children's lives are at risk, not just in school, but everywhere because of the lax gun laws we have in our country. And I'm determined, along with these other moms, to try to do something about it.
And so that's exactly what you were doing on Wednesday of last week when you were in Des Moines at the State House.
Exactly. So on the 16th, we had our lobby day at the Capitol. And this is our second year of doing a lobby day where we invite our members. We had a lot of our members from the Des Moines area, some from Iowa City, lots from Ames, who go down and, you know, these are regular folks just like us. And we invite them to come. We give them some guidance and explanation on how the process works. And they go and they meet with their legislators. And
so you travel together in a van or bus?
We all go together. Yeah, some, you know, different cars. We meet up. A lot of people bring their families, so we usually have food and crafts for people before we head over. And then we help them fill out their slips and, you know, tell them they can do it. And then they go up and they have these very meaningful conversations one-on-one with the legislators. It's very non-intimidating for them, I think. And then when they're done, they feel this enormous sense of accomplishment because they feel like they were finally heard on the issue. You know, we send emails all the time, and that's very important. But these one-on-one connections are so good because they can see that you're a real person, particularly those of us who have a personal connection to the issue, are survivors of gun violence, who can go and speak to this issue so personally and so powerfully. The legislators can't ignore that. We spend a lot of time talking to all of the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee because that's where most of these bills end up. And that's sort of the firewall to make sure that a lot of these, what I would call very bad gun bills, like Stand Your Ground and bills like that, that they don't move forward. So we spend a lot of time speaking with them because they are really the decision makers on these issues. But we encourage our members when they come to Lobby Day to make sure that they meet with their own representative because the representatives very much want to speak to their own constituents. And that is more meaningful than anything else. I hear that again and again when I go. It's, you know, they'll get a lot of emails from gun advocates from across the country, these gun lobby folks. They'll get emails all the time. But what they want to hear from are from their constituents on the other side of the issue. So a single heartfelt, informed email from one of their constituents means so much more than something from somebody coming from out of state. Right. So that's important, I think, for people to know, and that it actually – that going to the Capitol is huge, but just even sending an email makes a big difference for a lot of these legislators.
So who did you talk to on Wednesday?
Well, we spoke with a lot of folks. I know we spoke with Senator Steve Sodders. We spoke with Rob Hogue. We spoke with there's a representative from Iowa City.
Joe Bochum?
Joe Bochum, yes. We spoke with him. And we spoke with some of our Des Moines legislators, like Ruth Ann Gaines. Echo Abdul-Samad was there, and he was very generous with his time. We brought one of our survivors with us. She's a young girl in Des Moines who lost her brother. Her brother was shot and killed last year in Des Moines. And he sat down with us and just one-on-one with her, the 16-year-old girl, so brave that she came and spoke. He gave us time. He brought us to the House floor. He introduced her.
This is Akko?
Yes, yes.
Representative.
From Des Moines.
Right.
And he shared his own personal story of his son was killed in, I think it was 1997, by gun violence. And then he made a motion to introduce us, and he put us out upstairs, and then the House turned around and rose and applauded her sitting up in the balcony. For this girl, she got a standing ovation in the House. She felt that her presence was meaningful. I think it was very meaningful for her, and I expect it was also very meaningful for a lot of the legislators there to sort of have a face, to have that experience talking with her. And I was honored to get to be a part of that with her and support her.
There have been some really controversial gun laws that have come to the fore this season, mm-hmm. The most dramatic one being one that would give legal access to guns, mm-hmm. right, for toddlers.
Mm-hmm.
So where do those bills stand from what you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, there have been a number of bills. There's been changes in training for permitting for concealed carry. The handgun age restriction bill is the one you're referring to. The suppressors bill, I believe, just passed the Senate today. This is one that was part of the omnibus gun bill last year, and that one did pass the Senate today. But the others, my understanding is at least the handgun age restriction bill is not moving at this time. We are sort of waiting to hear on the changes in the training for permitting. These are people who are carrying loaded handguns in public. There was an effort to change the permitting process for that. We support any increase in training for this. We think that this is a public safety issue and that people carrying loaded handguns around our kids should have basic safety training. But there was an amendment which we supported that I believe increased the initial training on the initial application, but then decreased it on renewals. So we're still waiting to see the final language on that. It hasn't been finalized from what I understand. So we're still waiting to see on that one. Where we put most of our effort as an organization, it tends to be more on like the bill that was last year, the omnibus gun bill, bills that weaken background checks. This is where we put our energy, because this is the most important evidence-based thing that we know actually save lives. And this is also something that is widely supported. Over 90% of Iowans believe we should have universal background checks. So when there are efforts by the gun lobby to weaken those systems that are in place, we come out strong. And we did last year with the omnibus gun bill. There was an effort to essentially repeal the expanded background checks that we have on private handgun sales in Iowa. And we came out strong on that, and we won. So those are the things that we remain the most vigilant for, and we put our effort towards those. Stand Your Ground is one that we will consistently oppose here in Iowa. They've tried to introduce it now for at least 3 sessions. We have seen the horrible impacts of that, not just, you know, in Florida, but in a lot of the states that have passed Stand Your Ground laws.
Just for the audience, a Stand Your Ground law allows you to shoot in defense with very few questions asked.
Exactly. They're also called shoot first bills. So it basically removes all duty to retreat from a confrontation. And this is not a confrontation in your own home, because we already have very strong self-defense laws here in Iowa that protect you, particularly in your own home. This is if you're out in a public area. It removes the duty to retreat. So it's really a shoot first, ask questions later bill. And unfortunately, we've seen in states where they have passed it that there's been an increase in, you know, it just creates unnecessary violence and loss of life. And, you know, law enforcement doesn't support it. The Iowa Bar Association doesn't support it. No one is really asking for this except for the gun lobby. And so we know it's the right thing to do to protect our kids and oppose it. And these are very sort of middle-of-the-road common sense ideas that we're trying to share. I think it's really a testament to the strength of our movement that we have gone from this small online group to such a big, almost 20,000 people in Iowa in such a short period of time. I think that says a lot about the strength of our message, and hopefully what we can do going forward in the next couple of years.
Jess Calhoun from Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. Appreciate it.
And Jess said that you can hook up with the 20,000-strong Iowa group through their dedicated Iowa Facebook page, which will be posted on our website, khoifm.org, when we post this story. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we are going to slow down the pace a bit and change the mood. To do that, we've got William Elliott Whitmore, an Iowa native from Lee County, from his CD, Field Songs.
Protect us anymore. but the birds are still singing. Our earthly cares don't worry them. The melodies from the trees come down through the leaves and limbs. And we still have our songs. Let us sing them all day long. The hour of need. This is how we'll carry on. This is how we'll carry on.
And that's William Elliott Whitmore from Lee County, Iowa. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. We turn now to the story of a vegetable farmer who learned his trade the hard way. Rick Hartman and his wife, Stacy, farmed 10 acres in Minburn, Iowa, 40 miles southwest of Ames. They are in their 12th season as Small Potatoes Farm, a community-supported agriculture operation, or a CSA, that serves 80 to 100 customers with seasonal vegetables every week during the summer months, including some customers in Story County who pick up their shares at Wheatsfield Grocery. His story illustrates the need for a program that Practical Farmers of Iowa has developed, and we'll also be hearing about that program. Like most farmers, Rick Hartman first learned farming from his elders. But growing up in the 1980s and 90s, he didn't necessarily like where that on-farm education was leading him.
I grew up on a conventional type farm, although during the time that I lived there, through my boyhood into young adulthood, it changed pretty rapidly. We went from a small grain alfalfa corn-soybean rotation to corn and soybeans, and we went from having both hogs and cattle to just hogs. And so it wasn't atypical. In fact, it's the common pattern. I was old enough to remember the 1982 contraction of interest rates and also land asset values and other asset values. My dad lost some farmland at that time that he had just purchased not too long before. I remember also, too, I was raising hogs at the time and had a CD at the bank. I think I got it in 81. I was getting 12.5% interest, so it was a very different time. But it occurred to me that, you know, even when I was 12, it occurred to me that we weren't farming. We were just growing corn, and we were terribly dependent upon financial institutions and input suppliers. And the consolidation of agribusiness and the dependence of farms on agribusiness and farmers on agribusiness didn't make any sense to me. And I don't necessarily think at the time, as I asked the older men in my community why the transition, why the contraction of diversity, you know, why are you borrowing money at the bank to buy food for your table as a farmer? These were hard questions, but I got the sense that it was more out of what was expected and not out of what was sensible or reasonable. And I just grew a dissatisfaction for that change in what I saw in our farm and the community of farmers that I grew up in. And that's not how I wanted to continue my interest in agriculture.
So your interest in agriculture never wavered?
No. In fact, I had some, you know, I had jobs over my lifetime through my college years and beyond that weren't really related to agriculture at all, but I always was pulled back to finding a place to grow food for the household or to forage in the timbers and the streams near wherever I was living. In fact, the secret here about me, when I lived in Ames in my apartment, I used to tap the maple trees in the park and fish for catfish after it would rain down here on Squaw Creek. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, I don't know if you can do that anymore. And then how did you learn to do the kind of farming that you do now?
I failed a lot. And the only thing that saved me really was my stubbornness. And so I failed a lot and relied on not farming income for my life sustenance. And then after many years, I started to figure it out.
The business that he and his wife, Stacy, have developed over the years, called Small Potatoes Farm, is a very complex operation.
And because there's so many different cropping families that have their associated diseases and insects, and the type of farming that we do, which would be more ecological systems management, requires diverse cover cropping systems and crop rotations to be incorporated with this wide range of vegetable crops. And so there's so many moving parts.
Rick Hartman is now participating as a mentor in a program that is in its third year at Practical Farmers of Iowa. The program, called Labor for Learning, links aspiring farmers or beginning farmers with experienced farmers like Rick. Here's PFI internship coordinator Steve Carlson.
So a lot of times a typical farmhand will get a lot of experience in the field, you know, with production skills. And not often do they get involved with the marketing strategies, you know, or the financial planning or record keeping and those kind of business end things. And so those are important skills to have if you're going to start your own farm business. And those are skills that are kind of difficult to get, especially when you have to sometimes make a decision between going to school for something like that or, you know, getting your on-farm job.
Labor for Learning, which asks a little more in terms of educating the farmhand, also benefits the experienced farmer in several ways.
The experienced farmer gets an eager employee for their farm, someone who is anxious to learn the business of farming and to work hard at it. And the beginning farmer will get this on-farm, a paid on-farm job with this training. But we do ask the experienced farmer to put in a little additional training, you know, on top of the day-to-day management of their employees. And so we do provide compensation for the experienced farmer for the time that they put in training this aspiring farmer.
Participating as a mentor works well for Rick. He always needs seasonal farm laborers, usually one full-time seasonal worker and two part-time workers. In the past, he's had to hire people who just needed a job and weren't that interested in being farmers. When he became a mentor through Labor for Learning, that changed.
We were very fortunate. The person that was a beginning farmer that came to train with us through the Labor for Learning program, he had planned his farm over a long period of time and had saved up the capital that was necessary, had purchased the land that he anticipated using, all prior to coming to work for us. And so through this program, we were able to connect with him. He was an excellent candidate for on-the-ground, hands-on training, which is really probably the last aspect that he needed before he could begin his farm. And he seems to be doing very well. I see a lot of young people very excited about local food systems, getting involved in that type of production. And just because we're in this business and we love what we do, the laws of business are not suspended for us. And so as more than half of small businesses end up closing over a short period of years, so do small direct market farms. And young people tend to be, you know, to idealize the lifestyle. And there are many aspects that are ideal about, you know, what I do and what my peers do. But they often gloss over the realities. They're usually undercapitalized, and they don't have the minimum level of knowledge and experience to be efficient enough, you know, to have a stable, self-sustaining business and have some financial security. They often underestimate the amount of work and the time. And particularly at certain times of the year, there's
no social life.
There's no social life.
Except with your customers.
That's right.
And youth can get discouraged by failure and not understand that that's part of the process.
Yes, and impatience. I see a lot of impatience. I think, you know, the zeitgeist of our time is we get what we want almost immediately. You know, you can't have a successful, stable business immediately, no matter what you do. It takes a lot of work and it takes a lot of time. And sometimes a little bit of luck, too.
Rick sticks to a basic business plan of spending as little as possible on inputs, reversing the trend he witnessed in his boyhood. His production system is knowledge-intensive in terms of agronomy rather than finances, and that knowledge is what he imparts to his trainees.
Less than a half of 1% of our expenses are in the form of some kind of purchased input from off the farm. That doesn't include seeds, but we're certified organic. We try to use ecological systems management to recycle nutrients and suppress disease and pest cycles. And that's been worked very well for us. So we spend a couple hundred dollars in gasoline a year for a couple old tractors and very small amount of money for any kind of pest control or all of our weed control is pretty much hand cultivation. So we have a very resilient system that's not dependent upon large outlays of cash each year or somebody supplying us with a product. So in the third year, we decided we needed to shift our attention toward a good, durable fertility program that would have long-term levels of high organic matter that would release particularly nitrogen over long periods of time in a stable manner. And we have been, I think, pretty successful at that, but we do a lot of cover cropping. We use chickling vetch, winter rye, hairy vetch, oats, Japanese millet, buckwheat, Austrian winter peas, and I'm sure there's more, but those are the main ones. In the last 10 years, we've done really quite a bit of research on what our beneficial insects are at our farm and pollinators. And so we also do try to maintain a diverse habitat for pollinators and other beneficial insects and manage the farm in such a way to have a good reservoir of beneficial insects.
Rick has found this year's intern, but there are seven other paid internships still open through Labor for Learning.
And they're from all different enterprises. And so if you're interested in livestock, then I can help you go through these job descriptions and look at which ones deal specifically with livestock or have some aspect livestock on the farm. Some of them are row crops. Some of them are horticulture. A lot of them are diversified farms, so they do have a little bit of everything. I'd be happy to talk to any beginning farmer about what their interests are and help match them up with the right farm.
Again, that is Steve Carlson, internship coordinator at Practical Farmers of Iowa. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Greta Anderson, and it so happens I was lucky enough yesterday to run into Larry Callum at our station. Larry is one of the founders of Practical Farmers, together with the late Dick Thompson, and I shared Rick's story with him. The same period that Rick describes in the early 1980s, feeling something was wrong with the direction of farming, was when Larry and Dick formed the organization PFI. Larry had these comments on what he heard.
Farmers were coming through a very difficult time back in the early 80s when the organization was started. Rick talked about low input being one of his primary goals, one of his primary tools, really, in making the farm work financially. And we were dealing with thousands of people on the farm in Iowa at that time who were struggling mightily to find ways to survive. And PFI started out focusing on low input kinds of methods, practical methods, things that didn't cost a lot of money but that really worked. By people's experience, they knew it worked. They tried these things before, and they shared them with other people. So that's the beginning base of Practical Farmers. And then, of course, over the years, the organization, of course, has grown a lot since that time, too. And it's an amazing thing to watch.
You know, you go to a PFI conference and you see it's polished and professional. And yet it's great to know that at its core are still people like Rick Hartman, who are focused on that very thing, making it work, making farming practical.
It's been my experience in watching it over the years that Rick is rather typical of other PFI members in that here's somebody who's highly educated, who's very bright, and who's trying to find a way to make a good living without extreme reliance on capital. Intensive management is the key to this. Lots of times people in conventional agriculture who look at some of these things going on in their backyard and don't know exactly what they're watching will say, oh, they're just trying to go back to the 50s or the 40s. But it's anything but that. I remember my parents, as I grew up on the farm, they had these calendars that the bank would give them at the end of every year. Each month had a pocket in the front of it. And generally the farm wife would put the receipts from purchases in that pocket. At the end of the year, they would take all of these pockets to the person who did their taxes for them, along with their bank statements and that sort of thing. Well, that obviously doesn't work anymore. We're not going back to those days. To survive now requires intensive management. It requires somebody who's very much on top of their game, who knows probably more than the average conventional farmer does about what's going on in his soil and all of the other things, how doing one thing will affect another, the chain of events that take place in the whole system that they're operating with. It's a young person's organization to a large extent, I suppose. They have more labor than they have capital. Now, eventually, they're going to get older. There have been, of course, a great number of people who started out young in PFI, and PFI is still going, and they're still in it, but they've transferred over to becoming mentors now. They're passing on what they have learned, as Ricky is too, to those who come up after them. And they are so grateful for the help they got from the other farmers that they know they feel an obligation to share what they've learned with a younger generation. So when you go to a PFI meeting, you'll see a broad spectrum of ages. You'll see kids at a farmer's meeting, which is very rare anymore in farm organizations. You generally see a bunch of gray heads in the audience, but this one's different.
So I'm just surprised that PFI hadn't come up with this Labor for Learning project before now. It seems like a natural.
There have been several attempts at things similar to this. Iowa State and other organizations have tried it. But I think PFI's system, the way it provides grant funding and has access to a network of people, it's a very strong networking kind of organization. It has a way to bring in people perhaps more effectively than a lot of other organizations might have been in the past. So it works here where it didn't in some other cases.
Well, any other thoughts about PFI and the farmer-to-farmer learning that goes on there?
Most businesses have become highly concentrated, highly specialized, highly competitive. And to see pockets in the society where cooperation is prized and used as a means to succeed is heartwarming to me personally, and I think to a lot of other people too. It's a kind of human benefit that comes from that isn't always there in any strongly competitive business.
And that's Larry Callum, the founder of Practical Farmers of Iowa, and I'm grateful to him for sharing his time with me. I've been joined in the studio by Kay Puttock, who has another, we might say, heartwarming story for us about One Heart Equestrian Therapy, an organization that uses horse work to help people with disabilities live their lives a little more fully.
When I spoke with Chris Lager, the organization's co-founder and executive director, she had many moving and enlightening stories to tell us about the healing power of horses. And so in today's show, I'd like to add some more of those stories. Here, Chris begins by describing how equestrian therapy worked to help a mother and her troubled daughter.
One of the classes that we offer is for at-risk youth. It's complex psychologically. So with the at-risk youth management class, we use miniature horses, and they lead the miniature horse through a series of obstacles. The obstacles change, and sometimes the pony has never seen the obstacle. But my thumbnail version is if you take a knot-headed kid and a knot-headed pony, because I was a knot-headed kid and I grew up with a knot-headed pony, and I learned the pony always wins. So it changes our role as instructor from that of a boss to that of a cheerleader. We are only there to make recommendations. We are there to encourage our client to become a team with the pony and realized the pony had not faced this experience before. We're trying to encourage some empathy, and we're really focusing on communication. Communication does occur, and it's very visible. For example, when one young lady faced a very high level of frustration because her pony refused a unique obstacle, she stomped with pony in tow up to the front gate, and she flipped her ponytail. Of course, she was complaining. She rolled her eyes. She swished her hips and cocked them away from the pony and looked away from the pony. Meanwhile, the pony switched his tail, cocked his hips, looked the other way, pinned his ears, rolled his eyes. Total non-communication between both parties. They went at it again. And under some very slight supervision and some encouragement and some coaching, she managed to get that pony to cross that obstacle. And she carries that with her today. Because I went to the mother, do you take this therapy home? It's not supposed to be playtime. It's not for our entertainment. It's supposed to help. And the mother responded to me, when I get that same look of frustration at home, I change the conversation. I put myself in the role of the pony. And then I ask my daughter, how would you communicate that to your pony?
Mm-hmm.
And it changes the dynamics of the conversation.
The young client you've just heard about was more troubled psychologically than physically. But in this next segment, you'll hear how equestrian therapy can help people with very severe physical disabilities.
Our physical therapist has shown me a paper published that illustrated that in a 30-minute session, a rider in hippotherapy could receive 3,500 repetitions passively into their body. She explained to me that a lot of her clinical measurement was based on repetitions. How many times could she get a child to extend their arm, for example, to reach to the same object? She said she would die before she would get anybody to be able to repeat that 3,500 times in a lifetime, let alone what this passive sitting on a horse, the amount of input.
They have to keep in sort of in sync with the horse's motion. They're doing a lot of physical.
They get into rhythm. The people that are nonverbal. One of our examples is a person who lives in a group home whose staff comes with him. They've never heard him vocalize, but because of the amount of movement the horse is offering him in a very rhythmic way, he is able to move air, have his diaphragm move air over his vocal cords, and it's almost a singing style of sound that he mm-hmm. makes while he is riding. And the staff stands there and videos this to show headquarters that it's the only time that they have this person verbalize.
So he's singing with joy?
That's a good question. I can give you all kinds of the ways therapeutic riding is supposed to work, like the warmth of the body, the movement, the measurement of the gait, and all those different measurable dynamics. One of the things that I do as the director is that I approach families and staff absolutely abruptly and directly, particularly on people who are nonverbal. For example, we have a gentleman well into his 30s, lives in a group home, spends his life in a chair. This young man is incontinent. He drools. He has no control over his speech. He has no control over his limbs. He rides in a wheelchair with a cradle for his head so it doesn't flop from side to side. This person rides with us. We put him on the back of a horse. So one day when his entire family showed up, mom and dad, brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, and they're videotaping, they're clapping, they're encouraging, they're cheering, and they're high-fiving each other and commenting, oh, he loves this.
Mm-hmm.
My concerns, of course, as a director, go back to your question. Is this helping? Is he gaining? Are these sounds of happiness? So I approach them. How do you know that he likes this? I don't want to hurt him. I don't know how to tell. Oh, they assured me. Because they watched us mount him. He rolls up our ramp in his wheelchair. We put him in a sling, and we use a lift that was donated by the Christopher Reeves Foundation. And essentially, he's wadded up in his sling, and he's transferred over to the back of a horse by raising him out of his chair, sliding him over, and lowering him onto the back of a horse. And I asked the family, I don't want to hurt him. How do you know he likes this? And they assured me, oh, if he doesn't like something, he can go so stiff, mm-hmm. you cannot get him to bend. And here we have gone through all these extra manipulations just so he can get on a horse. And indeed, he loves this. He's never refused. He's never objected. And he comes from two counties away.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have riders from nine counties. We are the only PATH International Center in central Iowa.
If this kind of interaction sounds like something you'd like to be part of, there's a volunteer training opportunity coming up soon at One Heart Equestrian Therapy. Volunteers are needed to lead the horses that the client is riding, to walk beside the horse and rider as a facilitator, and for many other tasks. Anyone from the age of 12 on up is eligible.
April the 7th, we'll have our first training of the year. It's on a Thursday evening, and it will be from 6 to 8 p.m. There's no need to pre-register, and there's no need to have horse experience. So many of our people come to the arena because they're horsey, but mm-hmm. we have lots of volunteers who come to our arena because they are people-y.
Mm-hmm.
They're very, very interested in assisting people. We ask of our volunteers to commit to a two-hour-a-week shift.
Okay. They can find all the details on Facebook, or they can call you by looking at your website. But the date is April the 7th from 6 till 8. And this is One Heart Equestrian Therapy.
And I'll just add the details and the place, it wasn't quite settled where the place, which arena it would be when I spoke, but you can find all the details at oneheartHorses.org. oneheartHorses.org.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Greta Anderson, joined by Kay Puttock. We started with Keith Morgan of Story County Emergency Services. We then heard the scoop on State House education funding politics, or one side of the story at least, with State Senator Herman Kurmbach, Chair of Senate Education Appropriations. And spoke with a young activist from Ames, Jess Calhoun, a member of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Farmer Rick Hartman from Small Potatoes Farm and Steve Calhoun of Practical Farmers of Iowa talked about the Labor for Learning internship program, and we also heard from Larry Callum of PFI. Finally, Kay Puttock talked about One Heart Equestrian Therapy with its director, Chris Lager. This show will re-air at noon and 7 p.m. and is available anytime today through our automatic archives. Just look for Local Talk. A show description along with relevant links will also be posted on our webpage, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. Thanks to our webmaster, Ron Carson, for doing that. You can also follow KHOI on Facebook and Twitter and get updates and reminders about Local Talk. Our engineer for the show was Rick Morrison. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard Iowa native William Elliott Whitmore with a track from his CD, Field Songs. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or stop by our studio at 410 Douglas Avenue. You can can also follow our links on our webpage, khoifm.org, to get in touch with us. Your contribution as audience, as well as your generous donations, are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.